Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Colin Mustful, your host today, and I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Sigrid Lien, author of the book Pictures of Longing, Photography and the Norwegian-American Migration. Sigrid, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sigrid Lien is a professor of art history and photography studies at the University of Bergen, Norway, and a leading authority on Norwegian photography. She has published extensively on modern and contemporary visual culture and is the author of the first extensive history of photography in Norway. Sigrid, I'd like to begin with a short excerpt of your book. It's from chapter 3, the first paragraph. So just give me a moment here. I'll read the excerpt for our listeners. The young woman in the photograph sits alone on the prairie. The photographer is at a low vantage point in relation to the subject. The sky is big and the horizon line low. We look up at the slight angle to where she sits in front of the modest building, a tiny shack of planked wood covered with tar paper, and with a flat, seemingly endless landscape of grassland in the background. Even though the house is small and humble, the young woman is still, like so many immigrants, interested in presenting herself and her world with dignity. Through the little window facing the photographer, we glimpse neatly ironed curtains. Dressed in a white lace blouse and wearing a bonnet, she poses like a young woman from the urban middle class, straight-backed and deeply absorbed in what appears to be a book or magazine. Her posture and grooming stand in strong contrast to the dismal shanty where she apparently lives. Even though a shovel is leaning against the wall, her relationship to the landscape seems to be quite different from that of a farmer's practical, utilitarian perspective. The portrait of her is also clearly differentiated from the aesthetics of more traditional immigrant photography, which documents and dwells on the great size of the fields and the newly achieved prosperity. So I wanted to start with that because that's what I found most fascinating about this book was your ability to describe a photograph. And I found myself turning and looking at the photograph and analyzing it and trying to glean from it the same things that you did. So I wonder if you can talk about how you developed that skill to describe these photographs and analyze them.
Well, I am an art historian, and that's what we do, actually. We have to, you know, my training is very much into that, trying to put words into, we have to sort of describe our vision of the material, and in order for the reader to see or to sort of confirm that they see the same, or that they can falsify or substantiate my vision, so that image is also printed in the book for the readers to see for themselves as well. So that is actually art historical method, I would say.
Sure. Well, you did it quite skillfully, and it really kept me engaged as a reader. Let's talk about an early photograph, one of your father. Is that what got you interested in this type of history and in the photographs from Norway?
It is actually of my grandfather.
Grandfather, I'm sorry.
Yes. As a young girl, I remember very fondly my grandfather. He was from a small village south of Bergen, and I remember him sitting by the kitchen table, and sometime, not often, he would speak about his experiences in America as a young man, because he went to Montana because he couldn't find work in Norway. The plan was to make it a temporary home to stay, and to bring his daughter and his wife and his two daughters later, the day after following. But that dream didn't come true because his first wife sadly died. So he went back, but and I remember, I was very proud of having a grandfather who had been a cowboy in America. I would boast to the other children in the street, telling them about this. And then I forgot about it when I grew older. But then suddenly, as out of nowhere, a photograph popped up from sent to us by a distant relative that showed my grandfather in Montana on horseback. And I was then already an art historian, and my main interest was in photography. So I thought there must be thousands and thousands of similar photographs in other Norwegian and Norwegian-American homes. So that became really the starting point for my study. And also, at my university, was also the working place of Orm Øverland, who was an English scholar, American study scholar, as you call it. But he has been collecting or editing the Norwegian collections of America letters in several volumes for years, and he has encouraged students to also to write about the collections of letters from their own home places. So this different districts were around in Norway. So I met one of his students, and I was fascinated by her telling about these America letters and what they could say and so on. And I thought there must be a connection between letters and photographs. And that's how the whole thing started.
Well, you mentioned letters and photographs. You kind of talk about that in the book, pictures versus letters. Mm-hmm. What does each one can reveal? What does each one conceal? So can you tell us a little bit more about the value of the pictures versus the value of the letters sent home to Norway?
Yes. I think that the letters could speak about things that might have been difficult to express by words. And they have an emotional way of speaking that is different from bearing that may be different from the letters. They have, I've written about this. I propose that they have some sort of interventional potential. in history, and that they have an equally strong interventional impact and emotional hold as the letters. For example, even though people that wrote the letters would be cautious in encouraging their friends and relatives to follow them across the Atlantic, because, I mean, that would be taking responsibility of someone else's life, in a sense. They would be careful about doing that. But they could enclose images of the bountiful fields and material prosperity in America, and fertile images of fertile lands and wide stretched fields that were so different from the tiny little farms that we have in Norway. So the version of this subject could assume an almost poetic character. So that is how they could speak about how their the most important choice they had made in their life was a good and sound one. They could say it, they could express it more easily through the images, I believe. And also, I find that things that could be hard to speak about, like grief, could be also expressed by an image. I mean, sometimes these letters are very economic and very sort of they're listing up how much they've sowed and how much they harvested and so. But then a letter would perhaps punctuate this by saying, "But last week we lost our little daughter, but I'm enclosing an image of her so you can see how beautiful she was." So that is how they could speak about things that also were painful and hard to elaborate more in words, I believe.
Sure. Mm-hmm. How honest were the photographs? You have one subheading titled "Bragging Pictures." So were they just proud of what they had accomplished in America and wanted to show that off?
Of course. You can imagine coming from a remote valley in Norway, like Setesdalen, where they, right up to the 1960s, would wear these very solid woolen traditional outfits that they produced themselves up there. And coming over to America and just to experience that kind of modern materials, pattern, cotton, and so on, that was a new world. So they would send images home there's so many images that has the words "Do you recognize me?" written on the back. Mm-hmm. So that is one of the tropes, I believe, that are to be found in this visual culture.
Okay, well, they're all very interesting photographs, just to see the families next to their homes, and then yes, other people with their businesses, and mm-hmm, then with their horses and oxen.
Yeah. And these are images that show off their new buildings and buildings that we didn't, you know, the architectural styles that we didn't know in the home country, and they bring out the piano to the porches, and they their books and flowers and furniture and lace curtains and elegant clothing. So mm-hmm, so that is that is how they could demonstrate how life had done well by them in America, despite warnings from among other places, the Norwegian authorities, that were hostile to immigration in Norway.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk a little more about the photographers themselves and some of the techniques and technology around photography. You pick out a lot of different photographers and tell us about how they're able to capture these images and how they're able to use their artistry to do that.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. The earliest photographs or the most early collection in my book is the one by Andreas Lartendal, who came from Valdres in Norway, and I believe they were, as I write, discovered by chance in an old tobacco barn in Wisconsin, and they are now kept by the historical society there in Madison, Wisconsin. And this is a really, really beautiful collection. And he worked in what we call wet plate technique. It is a technique that meant that the photographer had to be very skilled technically, because he had to prepare his glass plate while traveling around, and that required for example that he had a plentiful supply of water, fresh water, and so on. So he couldn't do that in the winter. It had to be in the summer. So he was one of the itinerant photographers that I have been writing about, and he came from a poor tenant farming family in Norway, and he started working as a photographer in the early 1870s in Wisconsin, and. As I see it, his images, to a large extent, work as reflections of being a part of an immigrant community. He shows, I've written about three different examples of his portraiture. One is of an American Norwegian-American pastor's family who is posing under the Norwegian flag in their garden, in front of their house. They've even put a man on top of the roof in order to, you know, to expose the flag better for the viewers. So they are there. That is a way of signaling loyalty from the culture they came from. And also he is very keen on showing off his material wealth and that he has a prominent and trusted position. So I believe that Dahl's images and beautiful posing patterns that he develops they are highly staged, but also very sensitively and done in a way that shows that he really understood his sitters and their community and their values. So he also photographs a family of cow carpenters, and which in perhaps in contrast to the pastor, it does not speak that much about material wealth, but about professional pride and family togetherness. He sits there with his tools, just like, you know, as like in medieval paintings, people would sit with objects that would speak about who they were and their identity. So it's about professional pride, as I said, and family togetherness. But I also have written there about how there's another, there are other values that might be expressed, that there's a young married couple who sits there in front of the house with a banner behind them, signaling that they are adherents of Markedstrana, and they have the banner is saying freedom, equality, and enlightenment. So they engage the family portrait to signal the values on which they chose to base their new life on a new continent. So each in their own way, this itinerant photographer subjects speak about not only about their identity, but also their values through their posings and through the kinds of objects they want to be surrounded with.
Well, for as much as these people had and were able to show in those photographs, I'm sure it must have been hard for them to afford the photography. What did it cost for a family to purchase photographs like this and to make, be able to send those home?
Well, it's a long span of time that I'm writing about in this book, so I'm not going to be very specific, but they write about this. They write about having their photographs being taken and the plans of having it taken in a way that shows that this was a very serious thing to have done, and to and something that they would invest in, and that some, when there weren't any itinerant photographers around like Larsendal, they would visit the nearest small town where there would be a studio, and that could probably involve traveling for days and so on. And I also find it interesting to read the letters that describe their longing for photographs. So many of the America letters speaks about a genuine wish for portraits sent over from Norway. They are including photographs, and so there is a circulation. There's a transatlantic circulation here at play.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So I began with an excerpt from chapter 3, which centers a lot around Mina Westby, a female photographer. Mm. You mentioned that emigrant records from different counties in Norway assert that a third of approximately 400 people who stated photographer as their occupation on their departure to America were women. Mm. Can you talk more about Mina and about women photographers that you talk in this book?
Yeah. I think that is such an interesting aspect of this history, that photography also could intervene in history by giving young women, by working as a mean of their independence. Because, I mean, you have already read my description of her portrait that I happened to find in the Norwegian Migrant Museum. And then one of my colleagues here at the department, French department actually, had seen that I've you know, given an interview or something about my project and show, and talked about this image about the young women on the prairie that wasn't totally not interested in cultivating the land, but she's just sitting there waiting for her life to take another direction. She's and that young woman, as I said, is Emine Busby, who emigrated from Trysil in Norway in 1902. And that photograph of her may be a sad portrait, but since we know that she worked as a photographer during her time in the Midwest. But when she came over to meet her father and became very disappointed because she understood that she, for different reasons, couldn't rely very much on him. So, and she understood that she had to be able to make her living on her own. And then she ended up with as a settler on the prairie, but by taking land. And but she couldn't, of course, be there alone out there in the winters. That would be too dangerous. So she started working in Minneapolis and in another smaller town in Minnesota as a seamstress. And she, and I think it was there that she became interested in photography, and she started training as a photographer. But at the same time, she has not, it's a love story involved in this, but because I know from her letter that I happened to find that and that I was given access to by her wonderful family, that she met this young man, also Norwegian-American immigrant, young scholar, very promising young scholar, and they established a relationship, and he was writing to her and sending her, among other things, Russian contemporary novels and articles on women's liberation and so on. And she even engages in personal, in archaeological excavations out there. She on the prairie, and she borrows telescopes to look at the stars, and so she's a very capable young woman. And then it comes to a point where she's not sure about this relationship, and he says, "Please come with me to Paris. I'm going to study there now for some time." And she says, "No, I'm not coming unless I know that I can make my own make money for my own to support myself. And no, I'm going to be a photographer." So she puts her own independence before. I'm sure she would love to go to Paris, but she wants to be independent, and to have to establish a life on our own premises. So she, and then her sisters want her to come back to Norway, and she goes back to Norway and tries to live, starts a business there as a community photographer in Trysil, which is a small village near the border of Sweden. But then she understands that life in America has changed her. She has become more of a free spirit or free thinker. And she says, for instance, that I feel a little bit lonely here. My sisters both go to church every Sunday. I'd rather be out in the sun. And then she starts corresponding with her, the man who's going to be a fiancé. They take up their relationship again, and when he again, for the fourth time, asks her to marry him, she jumps on the first boat to America. And stay there for the rest of her life, and never photographed again. But she's not alone. I mean by using photography as a tool for as an apron for liberation, sort of. But it's difficult to establish, you know, whole life in America turned out for the majority of these women photographers, because they tend to, you know, to be hidden because they work in their husband's studios, and or they run their husband's studios. Mm-hmm. The studios is often registered in the name of their husbands or fathers or brothers or whatever. So I found it difficult to study them, but that's truly something that I would have loved to do more about.
Were you able to learn all that about Mina Westby just from the letters she sent home?
Yes, that is a good question. Because as I said, as I told you, my colleague here at the French department, he said that I have more pictures of Mina Westby, because, you know, she was my great great aunt, and I said, oh, really? And I said, and he said, I could put you in connection with her family, in my family in the US. So I went to visit her son-in-law, who is now 97 years old or something like that now, and he was so wonderful to me, and I got to stay in his house up in the area north of New York where I live now, and he took me up to this Catskills mountain where her ashes were spread, and that was the place she and her husband purchased because it reminded them of Norway. But they told me about her life and gave me other images, and then they told me also that they had stopped her from burning the letters, and that also when she died, they had found more letters in an old cupboard that was actually standing there still in the room that I got to sleep when I visited the family up there. So, I mean, I've been so blessed with all this help from Norwegian American family.
Sure.
Who have invited me to listen to their stories and to to read the letters and to see the photographs. So that is how I have come across this material. But that is not only true about Norwegian Americans, it's also true about some communities in Norway. For example, the valley of Setesdal and the village of Valle. Yes.
It's quite a story. Sounds like the contents of its own novel, perhaps a mini series. But it's wonderful that you're able to learn all that and then share it in this book. I want to ask you about settler colonialism. That's a topic that's come up, especially where I live in Minnesota, about how the land switched hands from indigenous to settlers. You do mention it in your book. You say only recently have Norwegian American historians begun to mention the Norwegian participation in this process of settler colonialism. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, I think that is a very interesting and important subject. And I've been to some Norwegian American conferences, history conferences, and I've been so impressed by these Norwegian American, particularly women historians, that has brought this forth, because Orm Øverland, who has collected and edited the multi-volume collections of letters, he has written also about the absence of narratives about meeting the other, that in other words, the indigenous population that was driven away in the letters. And because, as he says, the story about the heroic migrant settler is one that is, in a sense, incompatible with the story, the horrible and sad story about those who lost their land. So that is not, and I mean, it's only through glimpses in this material that that the photographs speak about this, or indirectly. As for instance, just a few weeks ago, I spoke to a friend here in Norway, and who has sent me this photograph of his grandmother that actually returned to Norway, but from her days in Dakota. She's standing there on a prairie and with her husband and her children. And it's one of these, it looks like so many of these immigrant photographs. But then I said, yes, but it is really so many sad stories behind that image about her life that the image doesn't speak about. And he says, yes. And sometimes the letter, the photograph may open up, you know, for further research, because he said, you need to speak to my brother, because he knows the story about how grandmother told about how someday the indigenous people, representatives from the indigenous population, or Indians, as the Norwegians would say, they were just standing there outside their house, staring at them, and they were very frightened. But it was a strong experience. They were standing there, and then they silently went away, and that image doesn't speak about that. And many, and that would not be the kind of image that was sent back home. They would sort of, there are some carnivalistic photographs that I found that show Norwegians dressed like Indians for you know, just as sort of dressed up for fun or something. But that,
sure,
that is in a period where where the Native American population already had been driven away, so they could sort of allow themselves, or they had sort of a kind of distance to it in a sense. But so that is how. I mean, it's only indirectly that the presence is there. Or, for example, in that Alistair, Gilbert Alistair's volume of photographs from Lanesbury, where he has photographed the people that are wandering in the streets in Lanesbury, and he has done a snapshot of the poor Indian that collects herbs in the area and sells them and so on. But he looks quite miserable, and that is, he is sort of marginalized in that Norwegian American village. So I'm looking forward to hear and see more about these absent histories, and I wish also that would have been more to say about this. Hopefully there will be more in the research that that now is going on. I mean, yeah.
Sure. Well, I applaud you for acknowledging it and for opening up to further discussion. I think that's very important. Mm. You also talk about the role of historians and yourself as a historian and how you convey this history. I'm going to read a quote from the book that I found particularly fascinating. Mm. You write, "Events of the past, like those happening in the present, contain an abundance of single episodes and meanings. What we do as historians is to reconstruct a kind of order and connection within this chaos through language. But this is also a process that demands that we reflect on our own position in history and on our distance from that which once was." Mm. So talk about what your perspective is and how it found its way into the book, and also how you managed to keep it out of the book so that you could be an unbiased historian.
I do not believe that any of us are unbiased historians in a way, because we all bring with us our different experiences and views on what is important or not. I mean, that kind of grassroots perspective is also that I've chosen, inspired from the grassroots, the great Norwegian American grassroots historians, is a political perspective and is a particular way of choosing to look at history. And I mean, I want it to be a story about ordinary people's lives and dreams, the lives of the many, not the leaders or the heroes, but women and ordinary families and so on. And in that sense, I think photographs works as a fantastic source. Yes. And as I write, as just like letters, I mean, maybe fragmented and they don't tell the whole history, and they are fragments that you have to put together in a way. Images work like that too, but they have a possibility or to intervene in history or to cut into establish narratives and complement them, or to challenge established narratives about history. Mm-hmm. So in a way that I appreciate very much. For example, that it is my choices that I bring along when I go to the archive. And I remember in Norfield, in the Naha archives there, it's a wonderful archive. But I said when I came that I wanted very much to look at if they had collections, albums, collections of letters and albums and memorabilia from ordinary families. And then they said, don't you rather want to look at the college founders' photographs? He was a very competent photographer too, you know. So that, and then I said, no, I want this. I wanted other stories, these other stories. Mm. And then they brought me this, I found this box of that belonged to the Callister family who lived in Chicago. And it was, it turned to be an archive created by the woman in the family. It was Esther Callister, who was the daughter of Josefa Callister, who emigrated from the south of Norway with her husband. And they became part of the Norwegian-American community in Chicago. And after her mother's death, Esther has delivered this box with all the albums and their letters and their, even their passports and so on from Norway. And it tells the whole story about their family, particularly the mother, Josefa. And I really thought that it was interesting because on the top of this box, there was a note from the archivist in Chicago that had received the material and from the family, and he sent it on to Norfolk, and he said this might be of use to Odd Blovold's book about Norwegians, the Norwegian church in Norwegians in Chicago. And so I, of course, I would be interested in seeing how Odd Blovold had perhaps used these images from the Callister family in his book, but they weren't used, he hadn't used them. And I looked at the book and it was almost all exclusively a story about men and that there had been leaders in the community, Norwegian American community, and established institutions. And of course, I mean, the efforts they have done are admirable and so on, I mean, it's also important to speak about how the lives of the women in this community would be. Mm-hmm. And that is how I wanted to read that, the material in that box in the Naha archive in Norfolk, as a story about itself, not as a source to its history, but something else about the Norwegian church in Chicago or something like that. But it was meant to be a documentation of the Callister family, and it should be read as that. But that story about that family is not, you know, atypical. I think it's quite typical, but not less important for that, I mean. So I really enjoyed, and I became very fond of that character, Josefa, who was quite colorful, and she loved posing. So she was photographed throughout her life and enjoyed it so much. And she loved singing, and that is also something that comes very much true in her. So, you know, leafing through her albums, you can almost hear her humming away on Norwegian songs that she put the Norwegian song text under the photographs or postcards of Norwegian landscapes and so on. So that kind of, that, you know, that material also speaks about their way of that ethnicity was important to them, or, you know, and their tightness as a family and their closeness to Norway that they can never let go of. At least Josefa didn't. It could be read on so many levels, that collections of that archive, actually, that archive, I believe.
And it sounds like there are probably a lot of stories out there yet to be told.
Oh, yes, I'm sure.
You've mentioned a lot of travel in your research. You were in New York, you were Wisconsin, Minnesota, back in Norway. Mm. Tell me about that archival research and how much time that took and what that process was like.
Yeah, well, luckily we got some funding from the Norwegian Research Council. So I started in Norway with Norwegian looking through the archive at the Norwegian Migrant Museum. And then I happened to get a Fulbright scholarship, so that made it easier for me to travel around in the Midwest. So I did that, and also in Norway, I was happy. I thought I had to limit this to make it somehow. I can't do the whole country. There's so much. Mm-hmm. So I decided to do case studies were to be found in two particular districts. So I chose the coastal district near Stavanger, and also the inland valley of Setesdalen. And I thought the fieldwork up there was such an amazing and wonderful experience, because as it became known in Norway that I'd started this work, I was invited up to this valley. There was an old man who had read in the newspaper about that project and my project, and he said, "You must come up here. There's so many stories, there's so many letters, there's so many photographs, and Narrow Valley is so narrow that, I mean, only one son could inherit the land in each family, and the other sons or daughters that wanted to stay in as farmers within farming as a sort of source of a living had to go somewhere else, and instead of going to that, then to Kristiansand, who was the nearest town, was to work, to be urbanized, they immigrated. So that was a part of their community life that so many immigrated. So then I contacted the museum in Setesdalen, and they said we could collaborate on this. And so we made a collection day up at the museum and a collection weekend, and people came loaded with bags, albums. Wow. And one, there was this woman also, suddenly she started singing while we were sitting there talking. And there's a tradition of songs. I mean, they would start these short songs that would speak about going and about longing and so on. So people in Setesdal, they still have that wonderful musical heritage connected to migration. And there's also a wonderful singer in Norway that has worked on this material and recorded it, I believe. But that was an experience that I will never forget. And all these stories that came up. I mean, that image with that story about the egg and bacon anecdote that they have in the book. It is a, there was this family that came and showed me. It's just a picture of three brothers from a Setesdal family, but there is a story about how it's connected to a story about how they all went to the United States, and they couldn't speak, of course, American, so it was hard for them to order food for the, when they first arrived. So they only ordered what they could pronounce, and so that became egg and bacon. So okay. so that picture, it says egg and bacon on the backside, and that story is connected to the family heritage in a sense. A funny story, but it's also touching in a way that's also sad in the family that they went to work for a car factory, and then they were buried next to in each other in America, just the same way as they're standing next to each other in the photograph. So, so that is the kind of stories that photographs bring forth in Norway, for instance. So, and that still are alive.
Well, you say you had a collection day. Well, I'm sure there are people, listeners, who have photos from their grandparents and great-grandparents who were Norwegian immigrants and letters that perhaps they can't even read because they're in Norwegian. Are there places that people can take those?
I'm sure that Vesterheim Museum in Decora, for example, would be a good receiver for that kind of material. And they would also be able to help with the linguistic side of it. Or I could also help for that way.
Sure. Yes.
So, please bring it to a museum if you're not interested in keeping it. But don't let it travel alone. Let it go with some information about who owned that photograph and or album or whatever it is. So because it's so sad, I think now, but quite totally understandable. That the way that these photographs mostly travel out in the world is from perhaps third generation Norwegian Americans that are no longer interested or perhaps no longer have the contextual information around these old photographs. So they choose to sell the albums, for instance. And I would hope that they would send them to a museum instead, or try somewhere where an archive somewhere where people could take care of them.
You mentioned in our correspondence, are you coming to Northfield again soon, Northfield, Minnesota?
Yes, I'm coming now in the. By the end of April, beginning of May, because I'm participating and presenting my work at the Scandinavian Era Studies Conference in Madison, but also present my work at the NAHA meeting that takes place on the 30th of April. So, but I will also travel to Decora and to Fargo to present this book.
Great. That's fantastic. Hopefully I get a chance to meet
you. Yeah, that would be lovely.
What are you working on right now?
Well, you brought up the subject of indigeneity earlier, and I'm actually working on that now in photography and indigeneity in a Norwegian context. because I was involved in a larger project some after I finished the Norwegian History of Photography and the Picture of Longing book about how European museums address colonial heritage photography. And that was a project that involved the UK and the Netherlands, which are, of course, as we know, former great colonial powers. So, but Norway is an exception in this context because, and I think that was why we participated as well, because we are a colonial, a country that formerly has been colonialized, but still have acted in a colonial way towards our own indigenous population, so which is the Sami population in the north. And so I have, together with my anthropologist colleague, Hilde Wallem Nilsen, I've written about how the Sami Museum in Karasjok in Norway address and use photographs in their exhibition practices. But in that work, I also understood how little there's done about photographs from the Sami areas. And I believe that the Sami population may be one of the most photographed people in Europe, actually, because they are the European Indians. And so people travel from France, from England, from Germany, as you know, to do ethnographic studies from the Sami communities and to produce an ethnographic for sales or for museum collections and or for worse racial studies, so anthropometric studies. But so far there hasn't been done an extensive research effort of tracing these collections. So that is what we've been working on. So we are tracing the collections and looking at how they have circulated in history and been used in for different purposes. So that is what I'm working on now.
Quite a project. It's important and valuable work, and I look forward to reading it and hearing about it when you publish your findings.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Dr. Sigrid Lien, author of the book Pictures of Longing, Photography and the Norwegian-American Migration. Dr. Lien, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.